Michelle, would you light the chalice, please? Thank you. As Michelle lights our chalice this morning, I share these opening words by the Reverend Leslie Takahashi. All that we have ever loved and all that we have ever been is with us on the brink of all that we aspire to create. A deeper peace, a larger love, a more embracing hope, a deeper joy in this life that we share. Love is the spirit of this church and service its law. This is our great covenant, to dwell together in peace, to seek the truth in love, and to help one another.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Oh, you did much better than the 9 a.m. folks. Not that that should matter. So Tracy is doing a sermon today called The Practice of Being Human, or To Practice Being Human. And I started thinking about how many different levels there are to practicing being human. We all think, oh, we're born human and we should just be and accept. But that's a real struggle. And one of the books that reminds me most of how important it is to practice a new habit to make us become the person that we really wish we could be is The Fabulous Flying Fandinis. And it is a very fun book with amazing pictures, but unfortunately I can't share the pictures, so you'll have to get a visual of a house with no doors, no walls, and just all trampolines and trapezes. When the Fabulous Flying Fandinis moved in, the neighbors said they were strange. "Strange house," said Mr. Smith. "Strange pets," said Mrs. Jones, as she saw the lions and tigers and bears. Bobby Brown lived two doors down. His mom said the Fandinis are friendly folks. His dad said, with lots of children to play with. "Why don't you go play with them?" "No way, forget it," said Bobby. "They could be strange, have cooties, or worse." But Dad just laughed. "Go on, go see." Mrs. Fandini answered the door. "Come in, come in." Inside, like I said, the house had no doors, nor stairs, nor walls, only trapezes. Trapezes full of fabulous flying Fandinis. "Jump on, join in," all the children cried as they whizzed above Bobby's head. "No way," Bobby said. "I might get a nosebleed, a blister, or worse." And when it was evening, the Fandinis mounted their elephant and walked behind Bobby as he went home. "So tell us," said Mom, "did you try something fun?" "Tell us," said his dad, "did you try something new?" "No way," said Bobby. But the very next day, Bobby decided to go in again. And he went to the door and, come in," said Mr. Fandini, "just in time for breakfast." Now, I want you to get a vision of what you typically would do for breakfast. However, in the Fandinis, a tattoo lady served pancakes on a trampoline. "Jump on, join in," cried the children. "Today," Bobby said, "I might get queasy, lose a tooth, or much worse." After breakfast, the little Fandinis took turns bathing by jumping from a high platform into a tub of water. "Jump on, join in," they cried as they dove without a splash. "Forget it," said Bobby. "I could catch a cold, belly flop, or much, much worse." And when evening came, they mounted their unicycles and pulled Bobby home in a little red wagon. "Did you join on?" asked his dad. "No way," said Bobby. "I might not like it." "You'll never know unless you try," said his mom. Next day, Bobby went back again. "Come in," said Mrs. Fandini, just in time to help with the laundry. "Jump on, join in," cried the little Fandinis, daintily hanging their socks while walking on the tightrope.
Gee, Bobby said, "I might get the hiccups or much, much, much worse."
"Why not try something fun? Why not try something new?" asked Mrs. Fandini. Bobby looked down at his shoes. At last, he confessed in a tiny whisper, "I might look stupid." The little Fandinis all spoke out at once. "Not if we show you how, just ask. Come on, hold our hands." And so with a friend holding tight to his left and his right, Bobby jumped right on that laundry line and Bobby joined in. And that night, Bobby went home by way of Cannon. And I think that we all have those times where we don't want to try something because we're afraid. I certainly, you can ask my family, ask anything to do with swimming or whitewater rafting. No way. I could get hurt or much, much worse. Yet there are times when we need to stretch ourselves. We need to encourage ourselves to try something new. Or to say to ourselves, it's okay that I don't want to try that, instead of living with the guilt of, oh, I should be doing that, I should be doing that. And that sometimes we just as humans just need to be. Thank you.
The poet wrote, "Later that night I held an atlas in my lap, ran my fingers across the whole world, and whispered, where does it hurt? It answered, everywhere. Everywhere. Everywhere." There was a man named Joe in Houston, helping by doing what he could for strangers of all sorts with all sorts of needs. Hurricane Harvey didn't discriminate when it flooded Houston. It rained and it rained and it rained on everybody. Joe paused briefly as the reporter held the mic. Joe said, "I've been thinking about why we're here, about what's our purpose on this earth." He paused again. "I think I know the answer," he said. "We're here to help each other. Hurricanes, fires, earthquakes, floods, bombs, and bullets, and people like Joe show up, doing what we can. Prayer can hold so much, and there is most surely joy and beauty and grace and gratitude in this world. But today, this prayer is for the helpers and for those in need, and it is a song called Lean on Me.
Oh.
month of September, half of all the non-pledge contributions to our offering will go to First Church's guest table. That's the First Friday community dinners, where it's a y'all come event. Everybody come and take a seat and enjoy a meal together. As we share our financial gifts this morning, think about the welcome table and the tears of joy that scattered throughout the gathering when we share a meal together. The first of our readings is a poem by Ellen Bass entitled "The World Has Need of You." She begins with this quote from Rilke: "Everything here seems to need us." I can hardly imagine it as I walk to the lighthouse, feeling the ancient prayer of my arms swinging in counterpoint to my feet. Here I am, suspended between the sidewalk and twilight, the sky dimming so fast it seems alive. What if you felt the invisible tug between you and everything? A boy on a bicycle rides by, his white shirt open, flaring behind him like wings. It's a hard time to be human. We know too much and too little. Does the breeze need us, the cliffs, the gulls? If you've managed to do one good thing, the ocean doesn't care. But when Newton's apple fell toward the earth, ever so slightly, fell toward the apple as well. And from Rilke, why then have to be human? Oh, not because happiness exists, nor out of curiosity, but because being here means so much, because everything here, vanishing so quickly, seems to need us and strangely keeps calling to us. To have been here once, completely, even if only once, to have been at one with the earth, this is beyond undoing. In 1935, a young Unitarian minister who had recently been appointed a professor of theology at a Unitarian theological school in Chicago made a second trip to Germany. James Luther Adams' first visit in 1927 was 6 years after Hitler became head of the Nazi movement and 6 years before the party came to power. When he returned, the Nazis were in control and the Nuremberg laws were in effect, defining who is Jewish and withdrawing citizenship from every German Jew. Among the German Protestant churches, there was very little resistance to the rise of Nazism, with one exception. The Confessing Church movement actively opposed Hitler at very great risk. They resisted attempts to organize German Protestant churches into a pro-Nazi Protestant Reich Church. Adams was compelled to ask hard questions, the first of them about his own behavior. These are his words. In Nazi Germany, I soon came to the question, what is it in my preaching and my political action that would stop this? It is a liberal attitude to say we keep ourselves informed and read the best papers on these matters, and perhaps join a voluntary association now and then. But to be involved with other people so it costs, and so that one exposes the evils of society requires something like a conversion, something more than attitude. It requires a sense that there's something wrong, and I must be different from the way I have been. When Adams returned to the United States, he soon came to the conclusion that it was time to confront his church as well. Come 1948, he had been a decade on the theological school faculty in Chicago, and had been involved that long in the First Unitarian Church there. The minister of that church, along with Adams and others, believed the time had come for the church to be different than it had been. The time had come to take action against racism, and Adams and others proposed a bylaw change supporting desegregation of the church in 1948. The church's board agreed to consider the proposal. Many, but not all, board members supported it. Debate ensued. Everyone felt their position was right, and so they talked. And they kept on talking. And the meeting lasted into the wee small hours of morning as frustration grew along with fatigue. Finally, turning to the person who had voiced the strongest opposition to the change, the strongest objection to opening the church to people of all races, regardless of identity, James Luther Adams asked this question: "What do you say is the purpose of the church?" Everyone fell silent. And finally, the board member to whom Adams had directed the question replied, "Okay, Jim," he said, "the purpose of the church is to get hold of people like me and change them." To get a hold of people like me and change them. After his experiences in Germany and in Chicago, Adams came to believe that voluntary associations like his church and like this one, these communities where people come and connect and belong and act together by choice, these communities are essential to a just democratic society. In church, he said, we learn to negotiate the tensions between our inner lives and our external behavior. In church, we get to practice that negotiation. In the spirit of the church, the spirit of the place where we can practice is love. These are Adam's words. Love is the power that holds the world together. And love is the power that when we are tearing it apart, it persuades us to come together again and start on a new beginning. It is a self-giving to a process of transformation. Now, I'm assuming that there are folks here among us who practice things. Maybe, I don't know, golf or tennis. In the 9 o'clock service, we had, people who practice cooking and twin needle sewing. There were some interesting practices. So I'm wondering, what is it that you practice? And why? Anybody want to venture a comment about what you practice and why? Yes, please.
Music.
And why? Practicing music to get better at music. Anyone else?
I practice physics. I want to understand how the universe works.
Practicing physics to understand how the universe works. Yoga, where's yoga? I heard the voice. Where are you? Back there. Yoga, what draws you to the practice of yoga?
Balance.
Balance. For balance, strength, and flexibility. And a hand here, yes.
Practice patience.
Dare I ask why? Practicing patience. Absolutely. Anybody in the choir want to venture a comment? Katie?
Voice.
Voice?
Yeah, singing.
And?
For joy.
Practicing voice for joy. Yes.
Music again.
Music again, and? Ah, so practicing music for solitude and trying to find acceptance in mistakes. Yeah? Okay, thank you. Well, some of you may know that I'm a dancer and I practice too. I practice because I want to know more, and as importantly, I practice because I really want to change who I am. I want to know what really matters about the choreography that I dance. I want to learn more about what I don't know. Lately, that's focused on how to make a spiral turn work consistently in both directions in a long line down the dance floor. Not my best thing yet. Practice. Practice actually reveals to me what is required of me. And if I let it, it will push me past my limits. When I'm at my best and practicing, it reveals what's required and pushes me past my limits. Now, that question that Adams asked his colleague on the board of the First Unitarian Church back in 1948, that question still matters. What do you say is the purpose of the church? And the answer the gentleman gave is still relevant. The purpose of the church is to get hold of people like me and change them. So we're better than to be taken hold of and changed than in church. Changed here, where we are held in the spirit of love, here where we get to practice what it means to be human. We could practice a lot of things, don't you think? And I bet some of you have ideas about what that practice might look like. What could we practice here in church? Practice being human. What do you think? Yes. The experience of diverse cultures, we can practice that experience here. What? Yes. Listening. I'm trying. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Very good. Yes.
Being welcoming,
we can certainly practice that here. You bet. Anyone else? Yes. So practicing racial tolerance, practicing that here, believing that it had been happening and learning that there's more. Yeah. So I have a list, too. I'll add mine to yours. The first thing on my list is that a church is a place where I get to practice dealing with my mistakes. Like the time I was confronted by a friend, a woman of color, who had been hurt by what I had just said to her. And I knew it. In the moment that I said it, I knew it. And I didn't know how to acknowledge what had just happened. If you had asked me, I would have said that, well, words failed. But in truth, actually, it was embarrassment and fear that silenced me. I had plenty of words. Fortunately, a wise soul sort of took me aside a little bit, almost as if to give me a hint, and said, well, what if your response in that situation was just simple? Just a few words, really just a question. What if you had said, when you saw the look on your friend's face, what have I just done? What have I just done? I am better at this than I used to be because I've had opportunities to practice with good folks like you. The second thing on my list is to practice discomfort. You know, it's that thing that happens when we've grown accustomed to or assumed or come to expect or thought we'd done right. When those things are no longer what they had been, things have changed. Discomfort is always in the mix when justice turns out to be something other than what I thought it was. Here's one of my moments. I used to think having a welcome table with room for everyone was enough if there were enough chairs and plates, and that would be fine. And then I found out that who sets the table matters and what they bring to that task. And then I found out that who extends the invitation to come to the table matters, because their assumptions and their prejudices show up in how they extend an invitation. The more I learned, the more my discomfort, the more I practiced, and I am still practicing. I am still practicing because it finally occurred to me that a respectful welcome matters way more than my being either right or comfortable. So I have two more things on my list, for now, anyway. Practice resistance. How can I resist something that is intangible or invisible? How can I learn to be aware of that thing like the fish swimming in water? How can I learn to be aware of that? It is dealing with white supremacy that keeps those questions on my mind. As that becomes more visible and more tangible, so does the harm it causes. When systems are set up so that people who are white like me are the intended beneficiaries of virtually everything in this country, then something is wrong. When persons of color gain access to and fair inclusion in education, employment, housing, health care, when the legal system is fair to all, and when all our neighborhoods are safe, justice will have trumped white supremacy. We have an opportunity to practice resisting white supremacy, starting on Monday a week from tomorrow with my friend Ken Wagner. If you have the time, can you make the time to practice resistance? Ken's a good guide. He'll help. And finally on my list, I'm calling this the practice of care for our neighbors. Too many of our neighbors experience bullying and assault and discrimination and more because of the way they look or dress or speak, or because of assumptions about them that others hold and others make. We need not be bystanders when someone nearby is potentially or actually at risk. Soon after the election, when this new administration's travel ban was being rolled out, an infographic was circulating on social media. It explained to people like me how to be an active bystander, how to intervene in ways that were more likely to de-escalate a situation, how to accompany the victim, and above all, what not to do. The graphic depicted a young woman wearing a hijab on public transportation and a white woman who was intervening to offer her a sense of safety and support. That graphic I have and I still use, and it has not only raised my awareness about what it means to care for our neighbors, but it gave me a plan. Something I could count on to guide me when I am scared out of my shoes in a moment like that. So I invite you, once again, right here with these good folks to practice care for our neighbors, transgender neighbors, immigrant neighbors, Muslim neighbors. There is a bystander training coming up here on October 15th. That's a Sunday following the second service. If you feel you can undertake that kind of care, please take that time and practice here among friends. Practice, because I must be different from the way I have been, because it's a hard time to be human, because when we are tearing the world apart, love can persuade us to come together. Because being here means so very much. Because everything here seems to need us. Practice. Because we are building a new way. Love is the spirit of this church, and it is our promise to one another that we will dwell together in peace, seek truth in love, and help one another. Practice, practice, practice.